You mentioned there were a couple of fires set after Mark's escaped, Tarkov said. Any chance he's involved? Hard to know, Vale said, but now that there looks to be a tangible connection, I'll look at this case differently. I have a message out to Art Rooney, the profiler. Her Samsung vibrated again and she held up an index finger while she answered the call. Art, just talking about you. Got something interesting on your case.
Saw your text, and I've got some things to tell you, too, on the arsons.
I'd like to share that with my task force. Can you Skype? We've got a setup here at the command post.
Vale glanced at Hurdle, who nodded. She got the user ID and passed it on to Rooney. 2 minutes later, the Skype tones were beeping and bopping over the RV speakers. Rooney's face filled the 40-inch flat screen that was mounted at the front of the room. They huddled around the TV as Vale made quick introductions.
You first, Vale said. An arsonist is no different from any other serial offender, he started, giving the other agents and detectives a quick and dirty primer. He has a particular way of operating that is identifiable to him. M.O., just like a homicide.
Behaviorally, Vale added, we look for those things that are unique to that offender, things he does a certain way because it's familiar to him and because it's got meaning to him. Forensically, obviously, we can also look at fingerprints he may have left on the items he uses, but the items he uses gives us something else, too.
Rooney picked it up. If an arsonist has a certain way of setting the fire, it can provide the linkage among the cases we've got where we're not sure if they're related. And if we can find a relationship, a forensic or behavioral trait from one case, added to something from another case, it might make the difference in whether or not we find the unsub. In this case, we had 6 fires that all appeared to be set by the same arsonist. In the most recent one, the investigators found remnants of a wooden match, and, most significantly, a small dollop of wax that chemically matched one from a case he remembered handling about 6 years ago. In that case, the offender used a candle with a hole drilled a quarter inch below the wick. He stuck a wooden match through the hole, then soaked the match in the jellied substance they use for chafing dishes. Morrison turned to Vale.
Sterno.
Sterno, Rooney said. So this offender placed the match very close to the wick. The candle started to burn, and when it hit the wood, the flame traveled down to the head of the match, where there was jellied string. It lit up and went down to the sterno can, which had the rest of the jellied substance, and a rag doused in gasoline that hung down to the floor. Rooney clicked, and crime scene photos appeared on the screen. Can you see these okay?
Affirmative, Hurdle said, almost absent-mindedly as he studied the image.
Successive pictures showed a flame-scorched sterno can, remnants of a match, a candle.
So this fire was not successful, Ramos said.
Right, Rooney's voice was off-screen, the crime scene photo still visible. Which is the beauty of linkage. We now know that this earlier crime scene may in fact be the unsub's first attempt, and he screwed it up. The fire didn't really take off. We found a partially burned body, too.
Very elaborate setup, Curtis said. What's the point?
Is this just something he enjoys? He turned to Vale.
What do you call it? Ritual?
Rooney answered. No, this is part of his M.O. At first glance, it sounds like this guy's a nutcase. Why such a far-fetched contraption?
It's a simple explanation, really.
A delay mechanism, Curtis said, to allow him to leave and get away. Once he lights the candle, he leaves. It gives him plenty of time to get a fair distance from the home before it goes up in flames.
Rooney clicked away from the photos and back to his face.
Exactly, Detective. We thought he chose houses in the boonies because they're served by volunteer fire departments which have longer response times. But there's another reason. He takes a long time at the scene, setting up this elaborate candle and wood match contraption. If he's in the middle of nowhere, there's a greater chance he's left alone. Fewer visitors, less chance some neighbor or friend is going to drop by or walk in on him. Theoretically?
Right again. This delay mechanism is another purposeful, well-thought-out scheme.
Smart offender, Vale said. Just like Mark's. And then something Rooney said hit her. They found a body at that crime scene? That's what I was told. I just got this information from the investigator and I called you first. I'll have to get more details on that early case.
I'd be very interested in seeing if that body had parallel lines carved into the abdomen and excised genitalia.
I don't think there was that much left intact, but you're still thinking these arsons are related to your case?
That brings me to what I've got for you. Vale explained how she had discussed the case with DEA agent Richard Prati and his background as a chemical engineer. And the diethyl ether you found at your recent crime scene? We found it at Mark's buddy's house, along with Sterno cans.
I need the forensics report on that. See if those cans match mine. I'll make sure you get a copy, Curtis said. She mentioned the homosexual use of the chemical and reminded him that Marks had used it to temporarily disable his victims. Rooney leaned back away from the camera. He rocked in his chair a few seconds, then said,
Okay, you've convinced me. I think you're on to something. We should compare files, share info. Have you discussed this with Tom? It was his case way back when. He may have some insight, given time and distance. We all mull our cases, let them percolate over time, right?
He's in Hawaii shooting his new series, Rooney chuckled.
That guy. Books, TV shows. Retirement's been good to him.
I'm going to sit down with him when he gets back, but I'll try him again, see if I can pull him away from the cameras for a few minutes. She thanked Rooney and signed off. I'm going to call Stuart Sheridan and cross my T's, make sure that stuff isn't his.
She pulled out her phone and dialed, identified herself, and reminded him who she was, as if he would forget.
Mr. Sheridan, we found a few other items at your place that I just want to make sure aren't yours. They're not illegal, but it has great importance to our case.
When can I get into my home?
We're almost done with our investigation. I can ask someone to call you with a better answer. But did you or your wife have a bottle of ether in your laundry room? It's also known as diethyl ether.
What the hell is that?
Guess that's my answer.
A chemical, not ours.
You want to check with your wife?
Hang on, he said with the enthusiasm of a turtle.
He muted the phone with a hand and called to Nancy, asked her something, then returned to the call.
No, she has no idea what I'm talking about. And of course now she wants to know why I'm asking.
Whoops. Guess he didn't tell her about the squatter.
Sorry about that. What about Sterno cans?
You mean the fuel they use for catering? Chafing dishes?
No. We haven't had any events or major dinners at the house in years.
Certainly nothing that we'd hire caterers for. And I'd never store chemicals or flammable fuel in my basement.
Asking for trouble.
You have no idea.
That's what I thought. Sorry to bother you with...
Why would this guy have that stuff in my house?
Nothing I can discuss right now, Vale said, but it may have connections to another case we're looking at.
She thanked him and hung up before he continued asking questions she would not be able to answer. She then called Underwood and was left chuckling at his voicemail greeting. Shooting in Hawaii, the TV series kind, not the handgun kind. Leave me a short message and I'll call you back. She told him what they discovered regarding the offender using the same chemical as both an anesthetic and an accelerant, and that it was important she speak with him before he left Hawaii. She had just hung up when several of their phones went off simultaneously.
God damn it, Hurdle said as he read the text from Leslie Johnson.
Another body, death of Bloodlines Vic. Vale locked eyes with Curtis.
Terrific.
Chapter 50. Mark sat in the back seat of his new car where the rear windows were darkly tinted. During his adventures last night, he had slit open the right pant leg of his jeans, so he decided to risk going into a 24-hour Walmart in Fredericksburg. He picked up two pairs of jeans, a pack of underwear and socks, a few shirts, more toothpaste, and hair dye. Even though it was pushing 1:30 a.m. and there were few people in the store, he felt self-conscious walking around, even with the hat on and the beginnings of a full beard. At the same time, while there was danger in being out in public, the challenge, the rush of pulling it off was worth it.
far better than the boredom of being stuck in a prison cell day after day. He walked by a clothing display showing a blonde model, and he flashed on his reunion with Jasmine. It did not go as he had figured it would. A part of him felt something for her. It was more than familiarity. A connection, perhaps. He had difficulty putting his finger on it because he rarely experienced such emotions. Anger, fury were more his speed. Love, family? He wasn't sure he truly understood those constructs. All he knew is that when he was face to face with Jasmine, touching her, he wanted to break her neck, end her life. That was the rage he was accustomed to. All in all, his encounter with her was not a complete loss. He showed her he could still find her, which was undoubtedly unnerving. If it made for anxious, sleepless nights, so much the better. But he no longer had a bead on Jasmine, and unless he could follow Vale again, it would be difficult tracking his daughter down. Since Vale had to have her guard up now, tailing her carried a lot more danger. He had done it successfully once, but attempting a repeat performance might be going back to the well too many times. While he was skilled at not getting caught, he knew when to back off. His ability to outsmart, to outthink the cops, was what had gotten him this far. One thing being locked away in a prison cell taught him was how mind-numbingly tedious life could be. Staying free presented its challenges, for sure, but they were good challenges. He might have difficulty feeling certain types of emotions, but excitement was not one of them. Chapter 51. Vale stood at the entrance to the apartment and pulled on a pair of booties, while watching members of the crime scene unit ply their trade. Curtis was parking the car as Vale stepped inside and found Johnson in the bedroom, right hand on her chin, studying the victim's body from several feet away, as if trying to make sense of it. "I'm here," Vale said. "Yeah, I can see that." "Are we sure this is a Bloodlines kill?" Johnson did not move. While still staring ahead, she said, "Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Go on, take a look for yourself." Vale snapped on a pair of gloves. "Who is this?" "Ada Cerulli. 39-year-old pharmacist, roommate, a factory worker who has the overnight shift, discovered her this morning. Best I can tell, Ada finished up at the drugstore, an independent in Manassas, around 6:30 last night. I can't account for her whereabouts after that. A neighbor thought she heard her come home around 9, but wasn't sure." Vale advanced on the bed and saw the familiar dried blood pooled, soaked into the sheets and mattress pad. "Do we have a time of death?" "Emmy said last night, probably between 11 p.m. and 1 a.m. There are tool marks on the front door lock." "Really? Forced entry? That's new. Why? Is this merely the evolution of M.O.? Or is it because this kill was done by Gaines or McFarlane and we had his bottle of ether so he couldn't use it to subdue her?" "What are you thinking?" She turned around and saw that Curtis had entered. She told him what her thoughts were. "Take a stealth entry, get into the apartment while the Vic's asleep, surprise her, no screams." "This is so different," Johnson said. "The guy we found in the barn, hacked up and buried? William Reynolds, Greeling, the cop, Tammy Hartwell, Nathan Anderson, all different." "Not all are different," Vale said, "and in some cases the change in M.O. was logical and purposeful and situational. In many ways, the kills are reflective of the offender's instability. He's on the run, homeless, he's adapted his M.O. to ensure success and meet his needs. William Reynolds is an example. Nathan Anderson was opportunistic. I don't think he planned to kill Nathan, but once he used him to get away, he became an asset for sex, and then a liability because he'd be taking a risk in letting him live." "So you think this fits with the other kills?" Hurdle asked. "Is Ada one of Mark's victims? And Gaines's?" "I think it's consistent with Mark's ritual. The difference in M.O. can be explained. Now, whether Gaines is involved, we may need to rely on forensics. And I need to go back and look at this entire case, rewinding to his first kills to see how I'd assess him and see how I'd look at the case if he had a partner. I basically worked off Thomas Underwood's assessment because I was new. I'd never do that now. So I think it'd be good for me to step back and take a fresh look at it from the beginning.
How long is that going to take? Hurdle said.
A lot longer than you'd like. There were 14 murders, not to mention all the recent ones, and the fires. Normally it'd take weeks, but we don't have weeks. I'll do it as fast as I can. Meantime, let me take a better look at Ada.
Vale started a few feet away from the bed, taking it all in. She moved closer and resisted the desire to study the bloodlines first, looking over her face. No unusual markings.
What's that?
She pulled out her phone and turned on the flashlight, shined it into the mouth, which was minimally open, teeth parted.
Hey, we got tweezers?
She moved into the hallway and called to a crime scene technician.
Tweezers?
The woman reached into her kit and handed a pair to Vale, who rushed back into the bedroom. Curtis saw her and said, "What's going on?"
"Found something, I think."
Vale maneuvered the prongs between the lips and slowly extracted a piece of paper. She flashed on a prior case where she had found notes hidden in a victim's orifice, a case that caused her a great deal of pain in more ways than she cared to think about.
"What is it?"
Curtis's voice drew her attention back to the present. She set the tweezers down and unfolded the note.
"What the hell?" Johnson asked. "A blank piece of paper?"
"Maybe," Curtis said. "I think I told you Jasmine got one of these from Mark's. Turned out it had indented writing."
Vale brought it over to the window and held it at an angle to the gloomy, glary daylight.
"It does say something." She kept moving it, trying to catch the shadows just right.
"Next in line."
"What?" Curtis said. "That's what it says. Next in line."
"Is that a reference to his bloodlines?" Johnson asked. "A tongue-in-cheek reference to himself?"
Vale thought about it a moment.
"Maybe. He's never done something like this before. Why start now?"
"Because we know who the killer is, and he knows me. Is this note meant for me? Is he telling me I'm next in line?" Her phone trilled. She slipped the note into an evidence bag and pulled out her Samsung. It was Rooney.
"Just found something," he said. "Where are you?"
"At a new murder scene. Since our cases appear to be related, want to stop by?"
"Text me the address. Might as well tell you what I found in person."
"Tell me now."
"It can wait till I get there. You've probably got your hands full."
"Can't argue with that."
Vale hung up, tapped out the info to Rooney, then faced Curtis and Johnson.
"Art Rooney's on his way. Meantime, I'm going to take a look around. Maybe I can see this from a new point of view."
Half an hour later, Rooney walked in and exchanged brief pleasantries with Curtis, Johnson, and Hurdle.
"Good to meet you all in person. So, where's our body?"
"Follow me." Vale led him into the bedroom.
Rooney stepped up to the victim and surveyed her from head to toe. Vale had never seen him at a fresh crime scene. Then again, given his military training, it made sense that he would conduct his business in an organized, systematic fashion. He finally stepped back and looked over the room.
"Okay, brief me."
They gave him a summary of what they had learned and explained their theory of why there was a difference in M.O. Rooney nodded.
"Very good. I agree.
We're looking into Ada's whereabouts after she left work," Johnson said. "It's possible she crossed paths with the killer at some point during the day."
"Could have come across her yesterday or the day before that. Not saying you shouldn't do your due diligence, but I'm not sure it'll bear fruit."
Johnson acknowledged Rooney's comment.
"Might be right. Might be wrong."
"And then there's the issue of this note," Vale said, "which is new. Has nothing to do with M.O.
"Maybe just a tweak," Rooney said, "at us. Not like we haven't seen that before."
"Where are we with the homosexual bars?" Curtis asked.
Hurdle frowned.
"Let's go into the living room. I just feel weird discussing this in front of the victim. I mean,
I know she's dead, but it doesn't feel right.
They moved into the elaborately decorated space where Hummel collectibles were meticulously laid out in a display cabinet whose shelves had been recently dusted.
We've got the two bars under surveillance, Hurdle said, and several others in D.C. and Virginia. Undercovers come and go, mingle, and report back. We've given them an old mugshot of Gaines, waiting on the DMV to send us what they've got, which is hopefully more recent. So far, no sign of marks. He turned to Vale. Where are you on your reassessment?
You serious? You think I can snap my fingers and come up with something on the fly?
Not like I've never done that before, but he doesn't know that.
What reassessment? Rooney asked. As Vale explained, Rooney sucked his teeth.
I think that's smart. You want some help?
From you? Hell yes.
Let's talk it through for a minute. Start at the beginning. What do we know about Marks?
Less than ideal childhood. Our knowledge is limited and based on interviews with relatives and neighbors because he refused to talk with us after his arrest. What we were told is that he was sexually abused as a child. My guess is that it stopped as he grew older because he was probably a big teenager and could defend himself and challenge the person who was abusing him. Likely a close relative. Father, maybe his mother. Hard to know unless he tells us. Not something he's probably shared with anyone, and not something he'd have shared with me even if I'd been successful in sitting down with him.
He's a sexual mutilator, Rooney said, if I remember correctly, from Tom's Wednesday briefings.
Good memory. He cuts the vix, parallel lines in the abdomen, and then severs the genitalia.
The genitalia seems pretty straightforward. What about the lines?
Hard to know. Comforting for some reason?
Vale thought a moment.
But why he did it may be less important now than the fact that he needed to do it, especially since we know who the N-sub is.
True. Except, Curtis said, that now we're looking at the possibility that Marks may have had an accomplice.
Yeah, Vale rested her arms on her hips.
Let's explore that. Rooney said. There's strong evidence that Marks is gay, and we know there are a number of gay serial killers who worked in pairs. Was there anything in the behaviors that might indicate there were two different offenders at work?
Vale mulled the files in her mind, thinking through each of the killings. Nothing that Underwood specifically called out. He did think at one point that there were two offenders. I saw notes in the margin of one of his reports, but he obviously abandoned that concept in his final assessment.
And what about you? Forget Tom's work on the case. What do you think?
It might answer a few questions I had in terms of things I couldn't account for. It was early in my career. I wasn't about to second-guess a legend.
But now you've got the chops to do just that. Rooney folded his arms across his chest. So, tell me, what questions did you have?
On the ninth victim, there were cut marks on the body that were different from the slices we'd seen on the previous victims. They were shallower and on the back between the shoulder blades. I couldn't explain that. It might indicate a second killer.
Anything else?
Vale's gaze drifted off up to the ceiling. Victim 10. There was something in the way he was penetrated that was different. Linkage to marks by the specific way the Vicks were killed is correct, except that the subsequent sexual interaction is different. More anal tearing.
Underwood interpreted it as more anger on the part of Marks, but it could indicate a second offender.
Curtis shook his head.
Without forensics, how do we know for sure?
Vale and Rooney shared a cynical look.
It's very difficult, Rooney said, because with a pair of killers, there's usually one alpha and one beta, the follower. And most, if not all, of the behavior that's expressed at the scene is from the alpha.
The subordinate watches or has a minimal role, Vale said. It could be because he's learning or he doesn't have the confidence he needs, or he's just naturally a beta and doesn't have it in him to lead, or he doesn't have what it takes to kill, but he enjoys interacting with the body afterward.
It's much easier to evaluate if there are two victims, Rooney said. The behaviors exhibited with each victim would likely be very different and more recognizable to us. For example, let's say both victims are sexually assaulted. Offender A kills his victim first and then has sex with the body, but offender B first has sex with the victim and then kills her.
I'm not sure which is more sick, Hurdle said.
Vale tucked some hair behind her right ear. The different cutting pattern on victim 9 could indicate that Marks, the alpha, was letting the beta, Gaines, if we're buying into his involvement, have his turn after doing the kill.
But then there are the fires.
That said, if we consider the arsons, most of them occurred while Marks was in custody, but the others were set after he escaped, she nodded. If the arsons were done by the same guy, that'd mean we're definitely dealing with two offenders.
Hurdle walked over to a window and parted the slats of the mini-blind.
What kind of thing would we look for in Gaines' background to know if he's a candidate for this kind of violence? Assuming Marks has a partner, how do we know if Gaines is the guy? How do we know it's not someone else?
Without standard forensics, Vale said, it's tough. We have to make reasonable inferences based on the behavioral and physical and forensic evidence, as well as some assumptions. But if the second set of cuts are indeed what I think they are, then they're both mutilators.
You mentioned mutilators earlier, Curtis said. What exactly does that mean, other than the obvious that he mutilates?
Robert Ressler was the lead author on an article about murderers and mutilation. They defined mutilation as the deliberate cutting of the sexual areas of the body, breasts, genitals, and abdomen. Almost 70% of murderers who were sexually abused as children mutilate their victims after death, and the number rises to almost 80% for those who were sexually victimized as adolescents.
So, if we're playing the percentages, Rooney said, we'd expect to see sexual abuse in Gaines' childhood and or adolescence. Obviously, just because someone was sexually abused as a child or youth doesn't mean they grow up to become sexual sadists who murder on a vast scale and mutilate their victims.
We know Marks was sexually abused as an adolescent, Hurdle said.
Don't know much about Gaines yet, Vale said, other than what's on his sheet.
I'll ask Johnson to look into it. Curtis took a few steps toward the bedroom.
Yo, Johnson. She entered with a contorted face.
You rang, sir?
Vale stifled a smile as Curtis explained what they needed.
Can you handle that?
I can handle that. Now, can I get back to what I was doing?
As she walked out, Vale said, sexually abused offenders are also highly likely to have sexual conflicts, sexual dysfunction of some kind, and sexual incompetence. Those would be harder to determine without actually interviewing Gaines himself unless he confided in someone at some point.
We can try finding that person, Curtis said, if he or she exists, but I don't think we can count on that.
Hang on a minute, just a hunch, but Gaines was picked up on a solicitation charge, right?
Vale pulled out her phone and started dialing.
I'm going to see if Tarkov can dig a little deeper, find out who the prostitute was. If we can locate her, she may be able to give us something on their interaction.
Find a prostitute? Hurdle asked. Bit of a long shot, no?
Maybe not. If I'm right, the prostitute will be male, in which case we can put our undercovers on this, the ones who are working the gay bars. But if it's a woman, we might be able to get something from her. If Gaines is conflicted about his sexuality, he might have gone to a female prostitute to prove to himself he was heterosexual. Maybe he had a hard time performing.
Rooney pursed his lips.
Worth looking into, Vale elbowed him. I think you've kept me in suspense long enough. What did you want to tell me when you called?
Rooney chuckled. Sorry, this morning I ran a search in VICAP for offenders who used anesthesia during the commission of their crimes, he said, referring to the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program database, and I found something rather surprising. There was a case where the unsub used ether.
Vale shrugged.
That offender isn't the first or only one to use an anesthetic.
Ah, but it's the only one that Thomas Underwood handled before he was a profiler. Right before the BSU was started, in fact.
That was Underwood's case?
Where is he going with this?
There's more, isn't there?
There is more. That same offender was later found to have started plying his trade as...
Anyone? Vale half-heartedly raised a hand.
An arsonist.
An arsonist.
And did he use ether as an accelerant?
Vale asked.
Rooney pointed at her.
Indeed he did.
And now I can't get in touch with Underwood. He said he was in Hawaii, but was he really? What are you thinking, Karen?
Don't be ridiculous.
So where does this leave us? Hurdle asked. Sounds like you think Underwood might be involved in this in some way.
That's not what I'm saying, Rooney said, but I'd be lying if I didn't tell you that I didn't start thinking what you're all thinking right now for a fleeting moment, because there's no way that Thomas Underwood is a killer, serial arson or any other kind you can imagine.
You sure about that? Hurdle asked, fixing his gaze on Rooney. I think we need to ask him about it, don't you?
Vale looked from Hurdle to Rooney, whose face remained impassive. Hurdle spread his arms apart.
Let me put it another way. Can you guarantee me that Underwood is not part of this?
Rooney snorted, but did not answer.
Art, Vale said.
Rooney looked away. No, I can't. No one can guarantee something like that, but
plain and simple, Hurdle said. Better not to assume. One of us needs to sit him down. Curtis, you worked with him.
Curtis drew his chin back.
Well, yeah, but it's not like I know the guy. We worked the case, what, 10 years ago? We exchanged some ideas. I didn't exactly hang out with him.
I'll talk to him, Vale said. I left him a message earlier today, but he's out of town and hasn't returned my call yet.
There are other explanations, Rooney said. That case with the ether is in one of Tom's books, his first, Killer Instincts. Never read it, but when I Googled the offender and victim, Tom's name came up in a Miami Herald article, a quote from the detective who handled the case. He made a point of saying something like, Agent Underwood's thoughtful analysis of the arsonist's motives put him on the right path.
Why was the FBI involved? Curtis said. You said this was before the BSU started consulting on serial cases.
After quickly incapacitating the Vicks with the ether, the offender threw them in his car, injected them with a drug, and drove them from Florida, where he got his victims, into South Carolina, where he killed them, crossing state lines.
And why is this relevant? Hurdle asked.
Rooney spread his hands. At the very least, if we look at the most logical or most likely scenario, it tells us that Roscoe Lee Marks and or his partner, assuming he has one, read Killer Instincts and took the idea for himself. It also may explain why Marks is wise to what we do and how we do it. Maybe he did read these types of books. True crime, case studies, that kind of thing, to learn how and why we do what we do.
Should we look over Underwood's books, Hurdle said, to see if there are other things the killer or he himself is mimicking?
Vale chuckled. I think he's written 7. It's gonna take a while. I only read his third one, Profilers Unmasked, which focused on the history of the BSU and its split into the research unit and what became the BAU. He gave some great insight into the thinking of the early profilers, but Douglas has written a few books too, and so have Ressler, Hazelwood, and Safarik. We've got no reason to think Marx was limiting his reading to Thomas Underwood.
Rooney shook his head dubiously. Might not be a good use of our time.
We can expand the task force as needed, Hurdle said. We've got assets at our disposal. Vale, I want you to track down Underwood. Leaving voicemails is not enough. I want him in a room.
Vale shifted her weight, uncomfortable with that prospect.
If you can't do that, let me know and I'll have someone else handle it.
We've got these books at the Academy Library, Rooney said as he pulled out his Samsung. I'll arrange to have them brought to your command center.
And I'll arrange to have several agents put on reading duty, Hurdle said.
The one with the ether, Vale said. Killer Instincts. I want to read that one myself.
Art, can you have the library hold that one for me?
Rooney shrugged.
Of course. I'm heading there right now.
Chapter 52. Vale walked into the Academy Library, a bright, modest-sized square room with adjoining reading areas and a two-story atrium that gave it an airy grandeur. Vale identified herself to the assistant behind the administration counter, and the woman handed over the near-pristine hardcover of Underwood's first book. Either this is a new copy, or it's not seen much activity among agents. She could not pass judgment, given that she had not read it herself. Then again, with the Bureau's intense pivot toward counter-terrorism and now cybercrime, agents and new agent trainees' time was better spent on reading law enforcement periodicals and books covering those topics. Vale glanced at the jacket and saw Underwood's bio on the rear flap. The snapshot was not the usual posed FBI picture taken in a suit against the backdrop of the American flag. This was designed to project the individual's humanity, a man with his dog, in this case a golden retriever. As she looked at his photo, she recalled her one and only meeting with him a few years ago. Is that the face of a killer? She skimmed his professional accomplishments and had to resist comparing her own career to Underwood's. Pulling her eyes away from the cover, she opened the book and perused the table of contents. A moment later, Vale found the case Rooney had mentioned. Michael Neil Coleman, an unsub dubbed the Planner, was an engineer who began by killing colleagues he worked with at a non-profit agency. He was methodical and calculating, and plotted his kills with the precision of an NFL coach's game plan. Contingencies were mapped out. He studied his potential targets for weeks, watching for patterns, determining weaknesses, and then striking with alarming efficiency. To hear Coleman describe it later during interviews with Underwood in 1979, killing became boring because he was so good at it. Too good. It lost its appeal and no longer presented a challenge. That's when he began starting fires. It was something new to master, and in the process he discovered the tremendously destructive power of a well-constructed blaze. It triggered a long-buried fascination with fire that he had passed over in favor of killing. It was only then that he realized he could do both. It was like learning a new skill and then perfecting it. For most people, the hobbies they took up included woodworking, photography, baseball, and then there were the deviants who enjoyed discovering new and interesting ways of dominating other human beings, ending their lives, and defiling their bodies. The use of ether as a means of securing his victims, and as an accelerant for setting the fires, received only cursory mention by Underwood, more as an example of the unsub's cunning than as an exceptionally different M.O. not previously encountered. Well, regardless of how little significance Underwood gave it in his book, it made an impact on our offender. But something was not quite right. That note left in Ada's mouth was a departure in ritual. Why? A threat? Or was it a clue? Since I took over Underwood's cases, and I was next in line at the unit. Vale told herself not to overthink it. She pulled out her phone and texted Hurdle. Anything on the surveillance cameras outside my house? His response came almost immediately. You'll be second to know. Vale tried Underwood again and left another voicemail. Got a question on one of your old cases. I know you're swamped, but it's time-sensitive. Can you give me a call as soon as you get this? She opened the browser on her phone and looked up Underwood's television show to see if there was information on where they might be filming. If Underwood was not answering his phone, she needed to track down someone who worked on the production who would. 10 minutes later, Vale came up empty, so she decided to call the network. After being transferred multiple times, she scored the producer's mobile number, figuring she would get a better response if she used the library's landline, which displayed FBI Academy as its caller ID. The man answered on the second ring. Vale explained that it was vital that she speak to Underwood. We talked a few days ago, and he told me he'd be filming until next week. I'm sitting in a cafe in Hollywood, Agent Vale. We wrapped 2 weeks ago. A chill shuddered through her torso. Why would he lie to me? Do you know where he is now? Have you had any contact with him since you finished? Nope, and no. Sorry, I can't be of any more help.
Did he seem to be himself? Was he stressed or acting strangely?
There was a pause.
What's this about? I thought you had questions on a case you've got. Sounds more like Thomas Underwood is a suspect.
No offense, but I'm the one who needs to be asking the questions here. Can you just save us both a lot of time and trouble and answer me?
He seemed to be himself. We filmed 3 episodes at a time, then we take a month break. And then he comes back and we do another 3 episodes. Nothing was unusual this time out.
Vale thanked him and sat a moment, thinking it through. Then she went back to his book and finished reading about the planner. 1/2 hour later, her phone rang.
Karen, sorry for not returning your calls. We wrapped filming later than scheduled, and I didn't even have time to go home. Had to prep for the trial on the flight from Oahu and buy a suit at the airport during my layover in L.A., headed off to Philly.
I've got some questions about the planner.
I've got other questions, too, but those will have to wait.
Yeah, I'm about to board my flight, so I'll have to get back to you on that. Well, can you at least answer a few...
Okay, he said sternly to someone nearby. I'll be right there.
Back to Vale. Look, I've still got a lot of trial prep to do. Email me your questions and I'll reply when I get a break in testimony. A couple of days, maybe sooner.
You know, I did a pretty comprehensive write-up on that case in my first book.
I'm reading it now.
Then you're not reading carefully enough. Read it again.
The phone was muffled a second then.
Wish I had more time. Send me that email.
No, wait. I need you to come.
But she realized he had hung up. She called him again, and it went straight to voicemail.
Vale felt like slamming the handset down. She took a breath and went about composing her message, keeping it as short as possible while touching on the salient points of her analysis and questions, questions that were carefully constructed to potentially glean information as to whether or not he could be involved without tipping him off. Not an easy task with a skilled profiler who literally wrote the book on interview techniques. Vale sent it off, then stared at Underwood's book. She opened the browser again and searched for the Philadelphia court case that Underwood was testifying in. After picking through a dozen links dealing with everything from jury selection to recaps of each of the murders, she found an article from 2 weeks ago mentioning that the trial had been continued for 3 months because of new evidence.
Another lie? Shit. Could Hurdle be right? One of us? A partner in crime? A mutilating serial killer? An arsonist?
If she called Hurdle and briefed him, he would likely shift substantial assets to Underwood. Was that the right move? Was it her call to make? Vale phoned Tarkov and told him to have officers start contacting the airlines to determine if Thomas Underwood was booked on a flight, domestic or international, and if he was, to find a reason to detain him. Vale sat back and played the case through her mind.
Start from the beginning. Mark's wife's death was ruled accidental. But what if it wasn't? What if it was his first kill? Well, his first intentional kill.
She pulled out her laptop and opened the audio file of the 911 call that Jasmine had made.
Operator, woman's voice. 911, what's your emergency?
Jasmine.
It's my mom. She slipped on a roller skate. She hit her head and she's...
Operator.
She's what, darling? Where's your mommy now?
Jasmine.
She's on the floor. She's not moving.
Operator.
Are you okay? Anyone there with you?
Jasmine.
My daddy's here. He's holding my mom. He's very upset.
Garbled.
I'm scared.
Operator.
Is your mom breathing?
Jasmine.
No, I don't think so.
Operator.
I have your address. I'm going to send an ambulance. Meantime, tell me what happened.
Jasmine.
We were in the other room, me and my daddy. We heard a loud noise like a bang, and we ran in and she was on the floor.
Garbled.
And she's not moving. She's not moving.
The sound of a child wailing nearly drowned out the operator's voice. The woman stopped talking and waited for Jasmine to compose herself, then continued, "Operator,
can I talk to your daddy?"
Jasmine garbled.
I think so.
There was muffled noise as Jasmine called out for her father, a disturbing hysteria permeating her voice. Frantic movement, more crying, tears welled in Vale's lower lids. It was tough to listen to. The pain in Jasmine's voice. She could not imagine what she was thinking, looking at her mother's unmoving body lying on the floor. Her life forever changed. In the parentage of a soon-to-be serial killer. Vale shuddered.
I've got to find Marks. This has gone on long enough. I have to find him.
Marks. My wife's dead. What do I do? I mean, what am I supposed to do with the body? Are you sending an ambulance? Vale shook her head.
Calm, cool, collected, clinical?
His wife just died. He should be distraught, but he referred to her dispassionately. The body, not her body. While it was possible he was in shock, the most obvious conclusion, given what they now knew of Marks, was that he killed her.
Did Jasmine see what happened?
She said she was with her father in the other room. Was she just covering for him?
Little girls love their daddies. Maybe he told her what to say. Did he threaten to kill her? Even back then when she was a child, if she told anyone what really happened?
If that were the case, one would assume she would have covered that in her book, but there was very little on her mother's death. Largely what was in the police report and on the 911 tape, as well as the medical examiner's conclusions. Vale pulled out her Samsung and called Jasmine, but it went to voicemail.
Jazz, it's Karen. I've got a couple of questions for you. It's important. I hope you're okay.
She tried the other cell number Jasmine had used and left a similar message. Vale set her phone down on the desk beside her laptop and went back to Underwood's book. She thumbed through the next case and the one after that. Then her eyes caught something, an offender who left a note in the victim's mouth. It was a blank. Except that indented writing was discovered. Vale felt a chill run from her shoulders to her legs. The hidden message the unsub left was, "Next in line." She paged back to the beginning of the chapter and started reading. The offender was Desmond Robert Branson, also known as the Atlantis Strangler. None of the behaviors Underwood discussed had any obvious connection to the Bloodlines case. There were no similarities she could find other than the note. Branson had killed 7 prostitutes by asphyxiation. He was almost caught by the detective, but Branson got the upper hand and disabled the cop and took him hostage. Vale sat there thinking. There was nothing other than the communication with law enforcement, via the concealed message, that bore any resemblance to her current case.
You're not reading carefully enough. Read it again.
She sat staring at the page, but not seeing anything.
Why would he say that? What am I missing? Unless he was saying that to throw me off.
Vale took a breath, then returned her attention to the book, speeding through some of the subsequent chapters before forcing herself to pull back and slow down.
Focus, Karen.
An hour later, she checked her watch, then dialed Jasmine again.
Voicemail. Damn it.
She got up, rubbed her forehead, paced a few times, then launched the app Uzi installed on her phone. A red error message appeared. It was unable to establish a connection with the tracking device, just as Uzi had warned her might happen. A window opened, asking if she wanted to enable an alarm that would alert her when the connection was reestablished. It warned her that constant searching for a signal would affect her battery life.
Fine. Do it.
She clicked yes and was about to put her phone away when Ramos called through.
Where are you?
FBI Academy Library. Why?
Got a 20 on Gaines.
No shit?
He's in the mountains. We were monitoring his cell phone in case he turned it on, and he did less than a minute, but it was enough to get a fix.
What's the plan?
Hurdle's deploying SWAT. They need their Bearcat, so it'll take them a bit to get up there. Tarkov and I have 4-wheel drive SUVs.
On my way.
Vale rose from her seat, the books still splayed open. Leave that stuff as is, she said to the librarian as she headed out of the room. I'll be back.
How are you going to get there? Ramos asked.
Figure out a place to rendezvous and I'll meet you there.
20 minutes later, Vale was climbing into Ramos's Toyota 4Runner. The undercarriage was caked with a mixture of mud splatter and salt from his winter driving.
I take it you do a lot of off-roading?
Ramos chuckled. I live in the hills, and when it rains, this thing's the only way I can get home. They were half a mile from the ping they had gotten when Ramos's phone rang. He put it on speaker.
Boss, you got me and Karen. How close are you? Hurdle asked.
Be there in a minute, Ramos said. You?
Not far behind, and SWAT's about 12 behind me. Take a look around, see what we're dealing with.
Got it. We'll take care of it.
Best views we could get from Google Earth show an old trailer of some kind, but the dense tree cover made it tough to see. If we triangulated on the signal right, it's sitting on land owned by someone else. 72-year-old Jack Welker. No priors on the guy, not even in the system. You'll see what looks like a large log cabin on the property. No idea where Gaines is exactly. Cabin or that trailer? Be careful. We don't know what we're dealing with. If Welker's a hostile or if he's got no clue who Gaines is.
Roger that, Ramos said and disconnected the call. A moment later, they approached the coordinates. It was indeed an old trailer, but not the kind usually used for habitation. This was a large 40-foot cargo container that was traditionally attached to a long-haul 18-wheeler. The tires were removed and the axles had been sunk into the ground so that its undersurface was flushed with the hillside, leveled with cinder blocks. Ramos pulled to a stop about 60 yards away.
Is that it?
If it is, we're too close. We should go back down the road a bit, get some cover from the trees where he can't see us.
We're just here to take a look around. Ramos shut the engine and pulled a compact pair of binoculars from the armrest compartment. SWAT's going to do the heavy lifting of flushing the jackass out.
I got that, Vale said, but I think we should pull back.
Ramos frowned and squinted, as if to say Vale was speaking nonsense.
I think we're good right here. We're 60 or 70 yards away. Safe distance.
How do you define safe?
That trailer bugs me.
Did you hear me?
He peered into the woods. I heard you, but I'm driving, and it's my truck. My call.
We've got a guy who's already tried to kill us with an automatic weapon. If he's got an assault rifle...
He doesn't. He left it at that house in Lake Ridge, remember? Shit. After all the ammo he blew through, he may be out of that, too.
How can you be sure?
How can you be sure of anything in life?
How did this turn into a philosophical discussion?
We don't even know if he's here. Ramos popped open his door. Let's go.
Go?
Take a look around. Those are our orders. Ramos studied her face. You can wait here if you want. He brought the binoculars to his eyes. I was expecting a small, you know, mobile home that people live in. What do you think?
Tactical challenge for sure. No windows, no idea what's inside, who's inside, harder to breach.
That blindness works both ways, he said. Assuming Gaines is here, he can't see us either.
Good point.
He pushed open his door. I'm going to take a look around. If he's here and watching at this distance, I won't pose much of a threat.
I think we should pull back or wait for SWAT.
I heard you the first two times.
He dropped a leg out and slid his ass off the seat.
So, wait.
Ramos closed his door and passed in front of the SUV.
Shit. I feel like a goddamn coward.
He continued another 10 feet when Vale cursed under her breath and joined Ramos as he trudged through the frozen snow and mud.
Thanks for having my back. I knew you'd come around.
You did.
I can tell what you're made of. You wouldn't leave a teammate to do the dirty work while you cower in the safety of a car.
I wasn't cowering. I just don't have a death wish.
I don't think anyone's inside, he said, ignoring her comment.
Why live in a rectangular metal box when there's a cabin with all the comforts of home a few yards away? That trailer could just be storage. He handed her the binoculars. Vale surveyed the structure.
Don't think so. Look at the electrical lines that run into it. Thick cables. More than you'd need to light up a storage room.
He glanced over his shoulder at her. Listen to you, Miss Electrician. Do you actually know what you're talking about?
No, but it sounded good, didn't it? If you really want to know, the satellite dish on top is what tipped me off.
Remo squinted into the distance and said,
Oh.
Not, oh, uh-oh. There are cameras. Keeping the binoculars against her face, Vale pointed. 1 o'clock and 11 o'clock. More toward the back. He might be watching us right now. I'm not getting a good feeling about this.
She handed him the glasses, and he slowed as he studied the trailer. Vale stopped suddenly and grabbed Ramos's arm.
Hang on, she crouched and gestured at something.
Tripwire, Ramos growled.
Son of a bitch.
Is he watching us?
Vale rose up. I think we should get back to the truck.
We're not a threat, especially if he's heavily armed. What are two cops going to do with pistols?
I thought you were sure he didn't have any more assault rifles.
I said we can't be sure of anything. He shoved the binoculars against her shoulder. We keep our distance, we'll be fine. She took another look. As she let her gaze roam over its metal skin, she saw cutouts, narrow slots, almost like gun turrets.
Vale pulled the glasses away from her face. I'm going back.
The crunch of tires on the frozen ground drew her attention. She turned to see Hurdle's SUV pulling to a stop. Walters, Tarkoff, and Morrison were visible in the passenger and rear seats. As she continued on to Ramos's car, she saw another booby trap a few feet to her left. She stopped and turned toward Hurdle, who was getting out of his truck.
Hold it, she said. Place is rigged. Tripwires. Could be mines.
Hurdle froze in mid-step, his boot hovering above the hard-packed terrain.
You shitting me?
What do we do now?
Walters asked.
Retreat, Vale said, 100 yards back down the road.
And wait for SWAT, Hurdle said. Back in the truck, now.
That seemed like a sound plan, until automatic gunfire erupted. Rounds struck the ground by Vale's feet and the tree trunks nearest her head. Lacking any cover, she and Ramos fled back toward his car.
Holy Jesus, what a choice! Do I want to get shot or do I want to step on an IED?
They made it back to the Toyota, its sides and windshield now pocked with large holes.
Son of a bitch, Ramos said as they got into the truck. I'm still making payments.
Keep your head down, Vale said over the cacophony of gunfire. Stay behind the engine block.
And pray he doesn't hit the fuel line.
I'd pray that none of the rounds hits us. Much more likely scenario.
Aren't you the optimist? Ramos said, struggling to stay low.
Vale was doing the same. She had twisted her body and was now facing the back of the Toyota, kneeling on the floor, elbows on the seat.
You have the cell for the SWAT commander? We've got to warn them. They could be driving into a minefield.
Text Hurdle. He might have a way of contacting them. She did just that and got an immediate reply. Already done. 2 minutes later, the armored SWAT truck slowly crested the hill and pulled in well behind Hurdle's SUV. They activated the PA system and directed Booker Gaines to throw down his weapon and come out with his hands on his head. Gaines responded by treating the SWAT vehicle to the same bodywork that Ramos's Toyota received, but with a far different result. Designed to stop 50-caliber ball ammo, the Bearcat's half-inch steel shell and 4-layer bulletproof glass absorbed the pounding well. A moment later, the SWAT commander ordered them forward. They did not stop in front of the trailer, however. With the sniper in the Bearcat's turret and officers at the ready in the gun ports on its sides, they deployed the ram at the front of the Bearcat and punctured the short end of the cargo container, ripping off the metal side.